My guest today is a member of the Métis Nation of Ontario with ancestral roots in the Métis Nation Saskatchewan and the Red River. She has over 20 years of experience practicing law and publishing extensively on the topics of Indigenous health and the law. She is a member of the Law Society of Ontario and the Law Society of Saskatchewan and has received a Bachelor of Laws from the University of Saskatchewan and a Master of Laws and Doctor of Laws from the University of Ottawa. In 2013, she completed a postdoctoral fellowship with the Indigenous Peoples Health Research Center at the University of Regina and is a former Canada Research Chair in Aboriginal Health and Wellness at Brandon University. She was the Associate Director for the Center for Health Law, Policy and Ethics and a part-time professor in the Faculty of Law at the University of Ottawa and has worked previously as counsel to the Native Women's Association of Canada, legal advisor to the Canadian Nurses Protective Society, and as an executive at the Aboriginal Healing Foundation and the National Aboriginal Health Organization. Senator Yvonne Boyer, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Wayne. I'm pleased to be here today.
Talk about your upbringing, growing up, and your family. I know you like to start off talking about your grandparents. Let's go back and look at the beginnings.
Okay. Well, I have to actually say that I'm on the land of the Algonquin people, that I'm a guest here today. So I'd like to thank them for that. And I'd also like to recognize my grandparents, my grandmother, Mary Rosalie Larocque and Louis Amab Boyer. And they were Red River people in Manitoba, and they went to Saskatchewan in 1904, actually. And my father was the youngest of 13 children. And so he was very much loved by his aunties and uncles. And sometimes it was 20 years between them. He was like the favorite little boy. And it was lovely being raised in that environment because there was lots of cousins and lots of aunties and uncles and hugs and kisses all around. Many of my aunties and uncles actually had worked in the healthcare field and had taken care of each other because my grandmother was born in 1881. So that was a long time ago. And the medicines that they used to keep themselves healthy and to heal others and to prevent disease and treat disease, many of these medicines came from the earth and from each other and the care that they gave each other. It was expected that I would go into nursing when I was young, and I did. I followed in the footsteps of many of my relatives. But the main point is that I lived with my auntie Lucy, and she had spent 10 years in a tuberculosis sanatorium. And I remember sleeping with her and my uncle, and her telling me stories and about what it was like as a child. She was 14 when she went in, and she actually thought that she was going to die. And so she talked about what it was like for her as a little girl and having to lay flat on her back, because in those days there wasn't any antibiotics. The rest cure, it was called chasing the cure of rest, flat in bed. She was in a body cast for 5 years because tuberculosis was also in her bones, and she wasn't able to move. But she talked about healthcare for brown children. Her background was Cree and Chippewa and French. And so she didn't look like the rest of the children. And she was tiny. And I have this visual of my dear little Auntie Lucy laying in this big white starched bed and her little hands and her little body being in there. But she was a fighter, and she was there for 10 years. But the bedtime stories that I got very much laid the groundwork for me for the work that I do today. And she talked about racism and how difficult it was to be away from her family. She saw her family once in 10 years because, of course, they couldn't travel. They were poor. It was a long way away. It was very much like residential schools. She basically grew up in the tuberculosis sanatorium at Fort Qu'Appelle. Her words stayed with me my whole life, and they still stay with me. So when I went into nursing, I was looking around. I worked in small 50-bed hospitals in in Alberta. I worked in areas where there was a high concentration of Indigenous people. And some of the comments that people made to me, because they thought I was like them, because my skin is lighter, I have blue eyes, that they had, many people had actually said to me, the only way that this Indian problem is going to get fixed is if we sterilize and then they stop reproducing. And those words stayed with me, and it angered me, and it set me on fire to do something about it, to really put my head together on what tools can I get that people are actually going to listen to me, and they will have to stop what they're doing and stop this racism. And so I started picking away at night classes. And when I did that, I was a single mom with three kids. So it was basically because I was on fire, I needed to do something to solve some of these problems, or at least try to address them. Because if I didn't, I felt that I would become complacent and I'd be like them. I knew that I was capable of multitasking and running the family and getting all of this done. And I finished my first degree at the University of Saskatchewan. And it was, I have to say, it was very difficult because I had my fourth baby in the first year of law school as well. So like, that was just insane. I wouldn't suggest anybody do that, by the way. And any advice I give people often that, well, no, I wouldn't say often, but sometimes people talk to me about, oh boy, I've got all these kids and I'm in university. And I, you know, I say, yes, of course you can do it. Of course you can do it, because that's the advice I got too. Of course I can do it. And I did do it, but it is hard. It's very, very difficult.
Wait until your second year before you have your fourth baby.
Yeah. And yes, that's right. And an income might be useful as well. So making it through that first law degree, it's kind of a funny story, Wayne, because my goal in getting through law school was getting on the good side of 50, which would be 51. As long as I passed, that was my goal. And to this date, nobody's ever asked me what my mark in debtor creditor was. And that's just a little tip for any law students out there. That was the first degree, and it wasn't until the years that followed that I was able to really listen to my ancestral voices, my auntie's voices, about what I can do with this degree and my knowledge of the healthcare system. So the next step for me was I was lucky enough to get a job at the Aboriginal Healing Foundation, and that's where you and I met, Wayne. And that was a turning point in my life. I moved from Saskatchewan to Ottawa, and I had four children. I had two dogs and three cats. And I moved into this absolutely incredible organization that I really believed would be able to advance some of these ideas of healing in that I was so passionate about. And it was true. I mean, I was able to, the work I did there was very much along the same lines as what I truly, truly had passions for. But I also had the most wonderful boss there. His name is Mike DeGagne, and he is the president of Nipissing University. And every time I speak about this, I mention his name. Because across the street, he said, I'd worked there for a little while. We worked well together. And Mike said to me, hey, Vaughn, you know, the university is just across the street. Why don't you think about doing a master's degree? And I'm thinking that, you know, I vowed I'd never step foot in a university after that last degree. But I started thinking, and he said, you know, it's not very far from here, and we can help you. You know, we'll give you some time off to do that. And I thought, well, this is a gift I cannot pass up. And so I'm truly forever grateful for Mike ever saying that, because it really helped. He was instrumental with his belief in education and his passion for education, that he was instrumental in advancing the health of Indigenous people in the work that I was doing as well. So when I went in to do my master's degree, I pretty much totally enjoyed it. And I shook up in my head everything that I knew about health and everything I knew about the law, and out came all these questions like, What are the fiduciary obligations between the government and Indigenous people in Canada? What is the constitutional status of Aboriginal and treaty rights to health? What are international rights to health? Where do women sit in Section 35(4) of the Constitution? So I had all of these questions. What about research ethics that are appropriate for Indigenous people? What about Indigenous-led research ethics? So all of these ideas came spilling out of my head that I was learning, I had learned about the law and how I felt that changes could be made in the healthcare system. So that was my master's degree. And I thought, okay, now I'm done. Now I'm done that. And I thought, okay. But then things changed again. I moved over to our sister organization, the National Aboriginal Health Organization. And there I started developing a discussion paper series on some of these topics. And that formed the basis for my next step in my education, which was a PhD in law. And within the work that I was doing at the National Aboriginal Health Organization, I was able to refine further some of those ideas that I had started in my master's degree. And I looked at omissions of fiduciary obligations as being a breach of the fiduciary law as well. So I was able to take it a step further and a step further and a step further. And then that was, you know, the PhD. And I thought, okay, well, now I'm done, Wayne. Okay, now what? And then an ad came across my desk and I saw Canada Research Chair, Brandon University. Maybe I can talk to some elders. Maybe I can put together a really serious research plan and look at some of the health practices that the elders can tell me about that can prove not only just a Section 35 right to health, but also the Indigenous laws to health. So I was fortunate enough to be awarded a Canada Research Chair through the Canadian Institute of Health Research, and I was able to examine even further some of these ideas that began with my aunt's voices when I was a child. So being able to take these ideas, I was able to craft a list of research questions that would engage appropriate research ethics, culturally appropriate research ethics with the people that I was going to be working with. And I was able to interview elders, like sometimes in their 90s, that were able to talk to me about the health practices that they had when they were children and their grandparents and what their grandparents did and how they stayed healthy. And so I was able to garner this rich treasure chest of information and able to put it into, okay, I'm establishing an Aboriginal right to health. To me, there's no doubt in my mind that's protected by Section 35. And also, by the way, there's also Indigenous rights to health. And so what my Canada Research Chair ended and I moved to Ottawa U, and I started thinking about, well, who knows a lot about this is John Burroughs. And I talked to John and I said, John, you know, there's something going on here that's really spiritually incredible, because the people that I talked to that were in the East, in the West, in the North, and in the South, all talked about the muskrat and how the muskrat was a good food for them to eat. And it was a clean animal, and the animal ate clean food, and it had a clean environment, and it was full of vitamins, and it kept us healthy. And I heard that from all over. Everybody mentioned the muskrat. And John and I said to John, I said, John, I think this might be the law of the muskrat. And John said, I think you're onto something. So at that point, I was able to work with John, and we pulled in Amy Kraft, who's our water law expert, Indigenous water law expert, Larry Chartrand, Brenda McDougall, and we were able to put together, we put together a SHRC grant that I believe would have been funded quite easily because of the intensity of and the importance of being able to bring together these people and identify some of the laws to health that are in existence in Indigenous law right now. So then I got called to the Senate, and a little bit, and all of that was put on hold because as a senator, I'm not, you know, those, I can't apply for any government funding, of course, but everything that I was doing there was just put on hold while I moved over to the Senate, and I've been at the Senate for about a year and a half, and I'm finding my way around. I believe I'm an apprentice, and I'm looking at this very much as a great responsibility that I have.
Yeah, it's been about a year now that you've been a year and a half. First of all, that's certainly something you didn't anticipate. When did you find out that that was happening?
Well, it was about 3 years before that I had asked if I would accept a nomination to the Senate. And that was the very first process when people were being nominated. So I said, sure, you know, I'd like to be considered for that. And then the next process came by and they said, if you want to keep your name in the pool, just let us know. And I said, okay. So I just kept my name in the pool. And I thought, I think being a senator would be a wonderful opportunity and a real honor. So that in the back of my head, I thought, yes, I really believe that I could do this and I would like to do it. And I think it would be a wonderful next step in Indigenous health and able to bring my ideas to Canada as a whole. And so I kept my name in the pool. And then one day I just got a call and said, well, we'd like you to, well, actually it was the Prime Minister that phoned and said, well, I've been following your work for a number of years and we think it's fantastic and we'd like you to share this with all of Canada. And it happened to be International Women's Day that he phoned me, March 8th. And I thought, you know, I am the luckiest person on earth. I'm honored to be able to do this. So I said, yes, of course, I would like to do this. So that's when it all began. And I was sworn in on March 20th.
So you show up for work on day one. And I don't know, what kinds of things are you doing and thinking about doing? Or
okay, so when I first arrived at the Senate, I think the best advice I got was to just listen to people. So I spent the first few months listening very carefully to what people had to say and learning who these people were that are our senators and relationship building and seeing who was the experts in certain areas. And I was just in awe of the talent that we have in the Senate at that, you know, at that particular moment. I thought, this is absolutely incredible that I'm able to sit here with these people that are so, have spent their lives fighting for, you know, justice and social justice and change and democracy. And there was so many issues that to me, it was like overwhelming with who I was sitting with and the people that I was learning from. So about the first 6 months I spent, you know, in the Senate, in the chamber and listening to people and meeting with people and talking to them about what they do and, you know, the whole learning about how the Senate functions, how the House of Commons functions, reading. I did lots and lots of reading about how things work. Then I crafted my first speech, and it's called your first speech, but it's basically your introduction into the Senate.
That was almost exactly 1 year ago. I'm looking at the date here, September 27th, 2018.
Yes, that's right. Yeah. And I crafted it, and it came from my heart. And I introduced my family, my kinship, which is as a Métis woman, this is what I am expected to do, is talk about my kinship. And then I talked about some of the issues that I had been involved in and how important it is that the rest of Canada knew about this. And one of these issues is the issue of coerced sterilization and a little bit of background on that coerced and forced sterilization. A little bit of background on that was that I was asked to do an external review of the Saskatoon Health Region in 2016 and 17. And Dr. Judy Bartlett and I did this. And the reason why I was asked to do this is because two women had come forward that had been sterilized in a Saskatoon hospital against their will. And these were the two brave women that led the way for the, I would say it's a forced sterilization movement that is kind of, you know, we're hearing about all across the country right now. So they came forward and they went to Betty Ann Adam of the Star Phoenix, and Betty Ann called me and said, what do you think of this? And I said, well, I'll tell you what I think of it. I say that's an assault. That's negligence. That's criminal. It's what about Section 35 rights? What about an indigenous right? What about the free, prior, and informed consent that we find in the United Nations Declaration of the Rights of Indigenous People? So I was quite vocal about that. And I received maybe three or four other interview requests from across the country and said the same thing. This is what I think of it. If you want to know, this is exactly what it is. You can't go sterilizing people when they say, no, don't sterilize me. And so I was very surprised when I got an email from Saskatoon Health Region that said, we would like you to do an external review on us. And I said, are you sure? Are you sure you know who you're talking to? As a matter of fact, I've been kind of like bad-mouthing you across the country. And, you know, here's links to the articles I've been talking about, you know, the practices at the Saskatoon Health Region. And they said, well, actually, the elders asked for you. And I said, okay, I will do it in that case. So then we enlisted, the good Dr. Bartlett to help. And her and I did this external review of the Saskatoon Health Region and uncovered that there were many more women that had been sterilized against their will. And an ensuing class action lawsuit came about. Elisa Lombard is the lead counsel on that. And this number has climbed to, I believe, over 100 now in the Saskatchewan area. I'm not 100% sure it's just Saskatoon, but in the Saskatchewan lawsuit, it's over 100. So in my first speech, I talked about this, and there were follow-ups in the newspaper, and people were starting to talk about it because women are shamed. They're shamed when they've been sterilized, and they don't realize that they're not alone. And so people are reading about it. They're being traumatized by what they're reading in the paper about these women that have been sterilized. And there's many Indigenous women who have been touched by this issue. I'm getting calls from one end of the country to the other. And it has now, that was a year ago. So within the last year, there's been a lot of traction throughout the country on this spreading. Like, women are talking about it. And I've been speaking in Northern Manitoba, and women are coming forward there. Women are coming forward in Ontario, Nova Scotia, the North. It's and there's other class action lawsuits that have been launched as well.
The Roundtable, WayneKSpear.com.
As I was going through this, preparing for the show, I kept having a kind of recurring thought. And you used the phrase, earlier in your life, you were wondering, what tools do I need so that people will have to listen to me? I wrote it down. That's exactly how you put it. And when we were at the Aboriginal Healing Foundation, this would have been 99, 2000, around there, residential schools were on the front page of every newspaper. There'd be days I'd come to work and there'd be three or four articles that would be in the news, and whether it was about the lawsuits or survivors coming forward with stories, things like that, right? So I'm reading this and I'm looking at Amnesty International reports from 2018 saying not only do we have these 1,200 cases of coerced sterilization of Indigenous women, but there's evidence here that it's still going on. This is still happening, and people are coming forward. And I'm thinking, why is this not on the front page of every newspaper? This is just so obviously a terrible thing. And so I'm trying to put those two things together, and I guess what I realized is there was probably, I know there was, 10 years at least of background work before it got to the point where people were paying attention. But I'm thinking, what are the kind of tools and scope of your work in the Senate? I mean, is this going to be like that, do you think? It's just going to take years of pushing, before people are paying attention, or is your sense that this is something that people are becoming aware?
Yeah, I think it's both of those things, Wayne. I think people are becoming aware, and within my office, there's a number of things that we are doing. There's a number of things going on in the country, and besides the class action lawsuits, which I think are also very important, because that forces people to pay attention. And but there are a number of things. I'm finding that my office is becoming much like a clearinghouse. People are coming to me with information. We are putting together a mapping project, somewhat like we had at the Aboriginal Healing Foundation. And our baseline data is the women, the red dots that are women that have been sterilized. But we're finding it's not just women. We find that it's intersex people, it's trans people, it's people with disabilities, it's people that are imprisoned. So there's, if you can imagine the map across Canada, we've got those pins in. Then we do the overlay of where the Indigenous communities are, where's the high populations. And then we do another overlay of the residential schools. And then another one of where Indian hospitals are. And then we do another one of mining camps. So we're doing this mapping project because I want to see just how bad this is. But we are not just going to do it in Canada, because we've got Peru. We've had Peru, provide very good examples on how they've dealt with over 200,000 women that have been forcibly sterilized, Indigenous women. So there's much going on, and there are other people that are doing work in this area. You mentioned Amnesty International. They've been great. The Senate has done a study, or is in the process of doing a study. Phase one was in the last parliament, where we were able to bring together testimony of some key witnesses and provide recommendations for phase two. The report has not been tabled yet, but it's not public, so that's about all I can talk about that right now. But phase two, we're hoping, will be picked up in the fall, as soon as the election is over, and it will continue keeping this in the public eye. Yes, and I do have to say, yes, it is still happening. December 2018, a woman reported in Saskatchewan that she was sterilized against her will. The same thing in Manitoba in December 2018. That's just a few months ago. So people are coming forward, and some days it is in the newspapers, but I do want to caution that is such a traumatic experience. From what I've seen is that women who have undergone this, and they're triggered again. It's like the residential schools. They're triggered all over again because of the trauma to their inherent ability to create life. So there's other things that are going on. For instance, Health Canada is working with Margot Greenwood, the National Collaborating Center, and they're putting a conference on how to address this in January. So stay tuned for that. That's coming, and there'll be some really good recommendations with key people that are going to be going there to discuss how they think that this should be dealt with.
Yeah, you know, when we were at the Aboriginal Healing Foundation, we were always very clear. Yes, we're talking about residential schools, but this is neither the first nor the last discussion that we're going to be having, because when you look across Canada and institutionalized racism, the hospitals, we went to the day schools, the Indian hospitals, I mean, a whole host. There really isn't any institution in Canada where you wouldn't find something akin to, well, you know, like what you saw in the residential schools, right?
Exactly, yeah.
So clearly the first item on the agenda, I would think, is to put a stop to this. But where do you think we need to go after that?
We're exploring legislation, and we've been working with the CMA, Canadian Medical Association. We're working with, I know the House of Commons has put together a committee as well, and they have provided recommendations. So there are other players here. I'm only one person in this, big picture. because there are other very important players here too that find this just as appalling as I do. And I do believe we're advancing. To me, it's never quick enough, because I'm going to tell you a little story here that just really, really got to my heart. I went to Saskatoon for a meeting, a conference or something, and it's late at night, and I checked into the hotel, and I'm at the front desk, and it's just the young check-in woman there, and oh, she said to me, "Oh, you're that famous senator." And I said, "Well, I'm not very famous, but I am a senator." She said, "You're the sterilization senator." And I said, "Well, that's the area I've been working in." And she looked at me and her eyes filled with tears. And she said, "They did it to me when I was 21 years old and I had 4 children." And she burst out in tears and I burst out in tears, and we're holding each other. And she said, "I'm 35 years old. My children are all grown. I want more children. And I don't have $10,000 for IVF, in vitro fertilization." Every day that goes by that we keep talking about this, the door closes a little bit more on the timing for her to have any kind of reparation done. So we've got women like her out there that could possibly be repaired somewhat. We need an organization like the Healing Foundation to address these issues.
I guess that's where I was kind of nudging you. I was kind of...
No, I've already thought of that, Wayne, because for the reparations, we need to be able to have reparations for all of these women, because even if they don't qualify for IVF, they may qualify for a reanastomosis of their tubes. So there's possibilities for these women. And the longer we sit around and talk about it, the door shuts a step further. I think that we need another Healing Foundation in a different form that would address this specifically. So, and I think that that's what we need to put together, like, tomorrow.
Yeah.
And there's enough people out there, and it's not a government run one. It should be set up like AHF was set up, Indigenous run. There was Indigenous staffing. It was all run by the people. And we need the people that know these issues, the people that have been sterilized. So, and there's lots of them out there, I'll tell you.
Talk a bit about, if you can, the sort of scope of what you can do and maybe the limitations as you see them. I mean, because there's going to be those too.
I'm used to doing a lot of things at once and moving very quickly on it. So I'm learning how to be very patient. That's something that I'm developing, and there are processes in place within the Senate that need to be respected as an institution, and that's I'm trying to work with the Senate. And like I said, the report will be tabled as soon as we sit, but it isn't always. It's not up to me. It's up to many others. And there are I sit on the Standing Committee for Human Rights, and this is where the issue of coerced sterilization has been placed. So there are other senators all throughout the Senate that find this just as appalling as I do. But the process has to occur in due course. I can't just jump in and start screaming and say, "Hey, we got to do it this way."
Uh-uh. Right. It's the chamber of sober second thought.
Yes. and that's the beauty of it too, because we also have to be very careful of who we're talking about. And you know this just as well as I do from working at the Aboriginal Healing Foundation on the triggers that are the words that trigger people. We saw it with the Aboriginal Healing Foundation. We see it with the sterilization issue. And we have to be so very responsible and so very careful on how we care for these people that have been truly traumatized. So it has to be strategically put together, and it has to be more than culturally. I mean, I don't know how many times I've heard this when I've asked about, you know, what are we doing about sterilization, or what are we doing about this? I hear, "Oh, well, we're doing some culturally appropriate education." And then my response is always, Well, what about the physical act of cutting fallopian tubes?
Yeah, yeah.
What are we doing about that? So it's there's people out there that are working in this area that care. And yes, I would like to see an organization like the Healing Foundation put together. And I believe that, that if you ask the women, if you ask that the 100 women that Alisa Lombard is lead counsel for, and Semaganis Worm Lombard law firm is taking care of, then I'll bet you they would say the same thing. Is, do they want to go through litigation? Probably not. But I think they'd be willing to if they had to. But there's ways to heal, and we both know that coming from the Healing Foundation. There are ways to heal. Is, you ask them, like we did at the Healing Foundation. You tell me what you want. We'll fund you that. We could set it up like the Healing Foundation was set up. I'd be happy to sit on a committee for that. And there's people like there's out there as well that would do that. So, you know, I believe it would be a next step.
Well, when I look at your CV, it seems to have been perfectly custom crafted for the work you're doing now. Of course, that's not a coincidence, but it is good that we have that background in the work that we did at the Aboriginal Healing Foundation, because, you know, you don't have to invent things from scratch. There were a lot of things we learned doing that, and I felt that should be publicly shared as much as possible, and that's why we did the book about it. And so there are models for where you could go. And I always felt that it didn't have to be the Aboriginal Healing Foundation, but there should be some longer-term standing organization, because you've got this whole history of historic trauma, and it wasn't just residential schools, and it has to be done in a very certain way, very thoughtfully and very carefully, right?
Mm-hmm. I agree. And there has to be a whole unit for reparation. And looking at some of the, you know, the work that's already been done in the world. Maria Sedano had, you know, a lot. She's done so much work with the women in Peru. And if you look at, it was almost like the Healing Foundation is at the center of it, with community people out in the indigenous communities talking to women that have been sterilized, and they're put on a register. Once they're put on a register, they are able to access health care, mental health care, housing, legal health care, anything to do with their legal rights. And then they start looking at what else do they need to make themselves whole again. So I think what will happen in January, this is going to be a very important conference, and I will be speaking about, you know, what are the long term, what we need to do in the long term, and putting a model together like the Aboriginal Healing Foundation.
And in the short term, in the meanwhile, let's say that they want to come forward and speak. Are you somebody that would be contacted for that?
Yes. People can contact me. And we have a little brochure that we send out where you can get help. There are helplines that are in 14 Indigenous languages. And there are people out there to help. And if you want to join a lawsuit, there are lawsuits going on throughout the whole country. And first of all, you know, the people have to know that they're not alone. And there are other people out there that are willing to talk to them. I'm not a counselor. I'm the one who would just find somebody for them to talk to. And in the meantime, we're looking at long-term solutions here from a systemic perspective.
What I'm hearing is that you're hearing from people, well, you've internationally, but also across Canada now.
I hear from people with the awfulest stories. I hear from lots of people. Women have called me and said, I've been trying to get pregnant for years and I can't. And I don't know if I signed a consent form or not. And so my advice to them was, I think you should look get your healthcare records. I can guide you on how to do that. then they can't read them. So I say, I can read them for you. I can translate that for you and tell you if you have been sterilized, and I can provide options for you for your next steps. So I get those kind of calls. I get the kind of calls that say, you know, I don't know why. I couldn't say no. I thought the doctor knew it was best for me. The doctor told me that, you know, my children aren't going to be right, so I have to be sterilized. So that there's so much power and powerlessness here. So yes, I get emails, I get calls. Sometimes I get calls like at night from women that are, you know, they've read an article and they're traumatized, and it's fairly easy to get a hold of me because I've got a website, and I'm happy to point women where they need to go.
And people can look up your website.
Yeah, senatorboyer.ca. There should be a link to it there. It's just fairly new and we're still getting everything up there, but we also want to have a resource center online. So all of there's work on commissioning from different people across the country. We've done an environmental scan of the North on the issue of sterilization. That's just an environmental scan. We're looking at within the prison system. There'll be a report online about that. We will have the mapping project online. We will have any other reports that that we commission or that other people have commissioned, PhD or master's theses that we've been researching what they are, and we will have those online in a sterilization folder. So people will be able to go online and look for these things for more information. So we'll have a whole section on that. It's coming.
Excellent.
We are very busy. We don't, you know, as a senator, I was really, really surprised at how hard we work. We're working really hard. and people don't know that, but I'm probably putting in more hours now than I'm working at least at the same speed I always have. And so are other senators. And it's beyond belief that, you know, how much we can actually accomplish in this role as well in making changes.
Well, my sense is that you've landed in a place where you kind of look around and you think, yeah, you know, I'm in the right place. This is where I should be, and this is what I should be doing.
You know, you go through that process. It's like, I'm in the Senate. Oh my God, look at this place. I'm looking around. And then the page is there showing you where to sit. And I sat down, I put my earpiece in, and I looked around and I said, this is exactly where I need to be.
Yeah, and you got a big throne in your living room now.
That's right. I also have a succession plan. I have two daughters that just finished law school.
Ah, there you go. Just like Bill Wilson.
Yeah. Yes, that's right. Yeah, yeah. The succession plan is working.
He predicted Jody Wilson would be a prime minister. So I'm wondering if he was right. Thank you so much for giving me your time today, Senator Yvonne Boyer.
Thanks, Wayne.